Disclaimer. The views and opinions you hear expressed by the participants in this show are not the views of AnimeNewsNetwork.com. The show tapes live some weeks on Thursdays at 5 p.m. Pacific Time. Check my Twitter feed, ANNZAC, for more. Enjoy the show. Hey everybody, welcome to AnCast. I'm Zach Burchie. Jacob is here.
Hey there.
We're also joined by Erin Dearden. She's been on the show before.
Hello.
You can find her YouTube channel at, why don't you say it? Why don't you say it, because I'm bad at pronouncing it.
That's okay. You can find me on the YouTubes at youtube.com/Erin Cerise. I do a lot of Love Live coverage, among other idol things and visual novel things.
Right, that's E-R-Y-N...
C-E-R-I-S-E.
Yes.
C-E-R...
I-S-E.
Just making sure. All right, today we're talking about the 2007 anime program Tengen Toppa Gurren Lagann. Gurren Lagann.
Gurren Lagann.
Do you say, how do you pronounce it?
Gurren Lagann.
Gurren Lagann.
With extra R's and...
Right.
Right.
Okay, this was an enormous fucking success. Mm-hmm. Hugely influential.
Right.
Made a giant... Left a smoking crater... on the anime industry and fandom alike, it seemed.
Especially because it came out in 2006, so...
Yeah, right.
Something that hit that year because it was about to kind of change... The industry was about to change a lot, so...
Yeah, I mean, it aired 2007. That was the year it aired. So it's 10 years old next year.
Oh, 2007, okay.
Yeah, that's when it aired on TV.
Okay.
That's when it aired on TV.
All right, I was...
Yeah, and so at the time, it was the biggest shit in the world. I remember it. We were also not yet in the age of simulcast, so it didn't really hit the U.S. in any real way until, geez, like a few years later. And the release was really fucked up and weird. Like, Sentai Filmworks had it, and then Bandai put it out in this really bizarre release schedule where it was like two DVDs with only like five episodes.
Yeah, so and like it was originally what was ADV had it, and then ADV like started dubbing it and had a release schedule for it, but then like lost the license or something like that, and so it was delayed further, and then Bandai put it out. It was eight sub-only episodes at a jacked-up price.
Mm-hmm. And that's unfortunately the version I have.
Yeah.
Really?
And, yeah, those haunted Best Buy shelves for a while. I know when I was buying anime, I was like, man, this, you know, what happened with that release? So, yeah, like, and then eventually got released, standard, dual audio and everything, but, yeah.
Yeah. So it was a pretty tortured release. I watched the first, like, four or five episodes, and,
Oh, it aired on Sci-Fi. That's how I watched it.
Yeah.
It aired on Sci-Fi's ill-fated sort of short-lived anime block.
This is also a show that has an alternate English dub. There's a dub for this that Sentai made that is not publicly available or commonly available.
Yeah, there are clips, and that's kind of it, I think.
Yeah,
yeah, right. I think if you look up some of Mike Toole's Dubs the Time for God panels, you can see clips of it on one of those.
Yeah, right, exactly. And so I didn't watch the whole thing back then. Everyone made a huge stink about it. This is one of these ones where I had freelancers who were super into it, so they were doing all the writing, and I didn't really have any sincere personal occasion to watch the show for work, so I just never really did. Like, I liked the way it looked, but I don't know, it just didn't really grab me that much. And I always, it's one of these things where, like, I continuously meant to get back to it. I continuously meant to go back and watch it. I revisited it in part, at least, for our Revenge of the Decade shows or whatever. You know, that's not exactly that wasn't exactly like a full-on sit-down, pay-attention kind of a rewatch. And so I hadn't seen it until you know, this past couple weeks.
Oh, wow.
Since then. And that's been years and years. So, Jacob, what was your experience with the show?
Well, I first started watching it on Sci-Fi. I didn't... It wasn't part of the fan sub circuit for me. I was just then watching some fan subs and not very many at that time. 2007, probably not many at all. But the... the airing on Sci-Fi eventually after Bandai did have it dubbed and everything, that was kind of how I experienced it. So I experienced a censored version with, like, entirely too many commercial breaks, and I kind of, like, I couldn't, kind of just didn't watch past a couple episodes because the Sci-Fi's advertisements and their, like, lower third that would dominate the screen during the airing or whatever was so distracting that I just didn't... I was like, this isn't really the way to watch this show. The show is, like, pure exuberance, and this is kind of obstructive in terms of trying to enjoy it. So I came back to it after it was released on DVD and watched it all that way with the uncensored and everything, which made the Bathhouse episode very different, because the Bathhouse episode, as it aired on Sci-Fi, was basically, like, 12 minutes long. So, yeah, that was weird.
And, Aaron, how did you watch the show?
I was aware of it when it was coming out. I heard all the buzz, and I always did mean to watch it, but I didn't get to watch it at the time. It wasn't until a couple years later, I think I was listening to the review that that Dave and Joel did on Fast Karate for the Gentlemen, where they basically said, oh, this show's so good, we marathoned the whole thing in, like, 2 days. And I happened to have some time at the time. I was like, I've got 2 days, so that's what I did as well. And that's basically how I feel like you should watch the show, is watch all or most of that whole first arc in one chunk, take a break, and then watch all or most of the second chunk. Just
because
it's a very fast-paced show, and you get a whole lot of energy going throughout the whole thing. As you were saying, keeping it sustained makes that show work better, I feel like.
Mm-hmm. That's true. I would argue as you get into the end, the last, like, four or five episodes become, like, a too much candy situation where, like, it's a little much all at once. But all right. So you took to the show, obviously.
Oh, very much so. It's still one of my top five favorites to this day. Not necessarily because it's supremely deep or anything like that, or even necessarily the most groundbreakingly visual work of all time. But I just really took to the characters. I really took to the visual style. I feel like the score in particular really grabbed me. I listen to that soundtrack all the time. And I do feel like it has some things that resonate with me to say, like in terms of human ingenuity and evolution and the human spirit and whatnot.
Right. Cool. All right. Well, good. I'm glad to hear that. I have a lot of feelings about Gurren Lagann, a lot of questions too, but let's start with the first half of the show. So let's just get into kind of a basic plot breakdown. Like, can you take that, Jacob?
Yeah, I can break it down pretty fast.
For the first half.
Yeah, so the first half, so we start deep underground with a digger, a young boy named Simon. Okay, so it's supposed
God
to be
damn.
Simon. It's supposed to be Simon, but they pronounce it Simon in the Japanese, which normally in the dub is changed to what is obviously Simon. But for whatever reason, they call him Simon in the dub too. So
I think they were probably afraid of the fan backlash if they changed it.
Yeah, everything in me is it's like Colin, Karen in Code Geass. It's like it's Karen and they're like Colin, and it's like no.
Come forth from the darkness, Arucard.
Arucard and. Anyway, so I'm just going to keep calling him Simon because that's what they say, but whatever. So Simon the Digger, his job is to dig tunnels so they can continue to expand and live deeper and deeper in the ground like meerkats or something. And so, and his best friend, after losing his parents in a horrible cave collapse, his best friend is this wildly over-the-top cartoon of masculinity named Kamina, who wants to reach the surface someday because his dad, like, escaped to the surface and he wants to, like, go find his father and, like, adventure out there in freedom where there are no walls keeping us down and stuff like that. So it's all just a bunch of puffery for the most part until a giant head falls through the ceiling into their underground colony, and the head is trying to wipe them out. It's trying to exterminate humans, and so they find another head buried in deep in the ground that they can control with a tiny drill that Simon wears around his neck that he's kept close to his heart all this time. And so they put the drill in like a key, turn it on, and it's robot versus robot, and they eventually escape to the surface where they find other escaped humans who are fighting back against these the people piloting the giant head robots called Beastmen, who are half animal, half human, and they are being set to exterminate humanity by their master, Lord Genome, King of the Spiral. He's like the Spiral King. And they don't really know what a spiral is, but they'll find out later. And so it's them gathering together a group of merry men and a couple of ladies to go and destroy the Spiral King, and so that is the so they can live on the surface peacefully. So that's the basic plot initially.
Right, and probably, you know, important to break down the characters. So Simone is
Simone, like he's Simone. Yay.
Simone is kind of portrayed as sort of a teenage everyman. Mm-hmm. You know, wants to learn. He's mostly there to react to Kamina, who is, I would say, set up from the beginning as a Daigoji guy. I'm probably gonna get killed in order to motivate the main character. But I don't know if that's just me being like, I know really all the tropes, or...
They're really explicit about it.
It's hard to say, because on the first watch, I think it took a lot of people aback what happened to him. But in hindsight, looking back at it again for this podcast, it's kind of like, how can that not happen? I can't see this character sustaining himself across a whole series and still being interesting.
When the other characters, even Yoko, who is the main girl, I guess you could say, of the series for the most part, Yoko, who is in love with Kamina, says from very early on, she's like, well, you can't live this way, you're gonna get killed. And he's like, well, Simone will keep me alive. And that's kind of the refrain. He's like, well, Simone will keep me alive, and if not, then whatever. But other people like comment very frequently that Kamina's way of life and his philosophy is basically just going to get him killed. Mm. So it shouldn't come as any surprise when it happens. But yeah, it does happen, certainly.
Yeah. And so eventually a woman shows up. Yoko, she has tits and a gun.
She has tits and a railgun.
I was about to say, don't you mean a pair of boobs show up?
Yeah.
Right. Pretty
and
much.
A butt. And a butt. Daisy Dukes.
Occasionally a butt. Those three characters are pretty much the core of the show. There's the fourth character introduced later on, a few episodes, like halfway through.
I mean, there's a pack of other characters, but it is explicit.
It's largely about these three.
Yeah.
It was obvious to me up front why this was absolutely fucking balls to the wall revolutionary in 2007. Because if you told me that the show was made in 2007, I probably wouldn't believe you.
Right.
Like, it was obviously way the fuck ahead of its time, and you have to give it to them for that. Right. Like, clearly incredibly influential. Uh-huh. It still looks great.
Yeah.
Like, we have the
really
Aniplex
does.
Blu-rays.
Like, I was trying to
it
think,
still
like, okay,
looks
how does
fantastic.
This hold up, like, 10 years later, basically? Mm-hmm. And I couldn't think. Like, this looks like it could have come out today.
Right. Yeah, and the animation, for the most part, is pretty spectacular. You know, as always, it's an animator's playground, you know, for the most part. But, I kind of couldn't believe how good it still looked. And the Kamina character in particular feels like, oh... Why hadn't anyone done anything like this yet? Mm-hmm. Like, this character is obviously super exciting and fun, and, like, it's pulling from...
Yeah, he's a paragon.
It's pulling from hot-blooded 70s robot anime, like, right. The whole thing is doing. The whole thing is a giant, let's put 70s super robot anime on steroids, mm-hmm. and a bunch of other drugs, maybe, and then...
Like, it felt like around that time in 2006, 2007... There was this kind of bro culture renaissance.
Yes.
I feel like I saw a lot of bromance and bro this and bro that.
Yeah.
And of course, a character like Kamina fits into that mold just perfectly and turns it up to 50,000.
Right. And for the time, I can see... So Gurren Lagann was huge in Chan culture, obviously, back in the day, and was responsible for a lot of memes. And you can see nascent, like, just hints of the culture that would come. As a result afterward, I'm pointing that out as if you're interested in like social studies, a little cultural anthropology.
Yeah.
Watching Gurren Lagann will tell you a little bit about the current state of the internet from 10 years ago.
Right.
This show being particularly popular can tell you a few things about the culture at the time and where it came from. But I think all of that is largely sort of secondary. And I feel like the first half of the show is definitely the good part.
Mm-hmm.
Is that the consensus?
It's technically the first...
15 episodes.
70% or so.
Yeah.
It's a little more than half, but it is...
I would say that, although I feel like I'm one of the rare ones who likes the second half better.
Is that rare? Because we got, like, plenty of questions saying, like, you know, I actually like the second half more than the first, or just as much, or I don't get the complaints about the second half, so I don't know if it's more of a prevailing view now that, well, the whole thing's good.
Split. Who knows?
I've seen a lot on both camps, so I'm not sure. I can say it's not overwhelmingly. It's not one of those things where it's fan consensus is this jump the shark here or whatever. It's It is. There are definitely camps on this one. I'm firmly in the slightly bigger camp that the show kind of doesn't need as much time on the anti-spiral. Like, have the anti-spiral stuff happen, but it spends too much time on it, and it is a step down because Gurren Lagann at that point tries to take itself more seriously, and I think that it doesn't really have the weight to do that very successfully. I think it's a step down, but that's just me personally.
Yeah, well, I mean, so the first half of this show, well, not the first half, okay, I don't need to split hairs that much. The first half I felt was really, really strong. I feel like episode 15 is pretty much the you know, episode from 10 to 15 or so is the strongest peak of the show. Uh-huh. I thought 11 and 12, which is sort of the Evangelion-esque coming out of depression, finding motivation and doing some deep introspection. And introspection was definitely where the writing was the strongest in the show. And it also was the part that I connected with emotionally, because the rest of it felt sort of like, for the first 15 episodes, the show's cartoonish concept of masculinity is believable. Like, I can kind of get behind it as an abstract. Like, if you're presenting this to me as an abstract, not as a legitimately believable worldview that you're pushing as, like, right, here's a prescription for society, which is absolutely not what Gurren Lagann's doing.
Yeah, I think that's what makes the second half difficult, is it's,
right,
it's putting Kamina's lofty ideals behind an evolving societal structure, which seems silly to me, and
right,
becomes kind of a little bit like, I don't know, like when they try to sort of straw man some obstructions to it that don't really make sense and that feel false to the characters and feel like kind of broad, like we need something to come up against this without promoting any ideas of like subjugation or imperialism, because we said that was bad in the first half. So how about literally sort of a gestalt entity that just doesn't want people to live at all? We need to create that in order for this to actually mean anything. So anyway, it's kind of a long-winded explanation to saying the anti-spirals are kind of a weak antagonist, but you know.
Well, and it feels like they exist because they had to get this thing to 26 broadcast episodes, not necessarily because they had story.
Right.
Because, you know, as I was reading interviews and stuff behind the scenes about this, initially they thought they had enough story for, like, sequels upon sequels upon sequels. But the screenwriter, who also, of course, this entire creative team made the show again and called it Kill the Kill.
Yes.
The screenwriter said, like, well, I thought I had all this, but he had so much exuberance for the story that they were blowing through story arcs really fast.
Mm-hmm.
And it feels like
it. The first half is fast-paced, like,
yeah,
fabulously fast.
Like, you could blow that out into a full season on its own.
Yeah, I think the pacing of that first half is basically perfect for the kind of show that they're trying to make. The second half, not so much.
Right, and so that shows itself. It's also why they're like, no, we're ending, and there will be no more story on Gurren Lagann. This is it.
Mm-hmm.
With the end, because initially they're like, well, we thought we had a bunch, but we blew through all of that, and it was a struggle to come up with this shit at the end.
Right.
So forget it. There will be no more Gurren Lagann.
Well, that makes that's a really salient point when it comes to Gurren Lagann in terms of writing quality. People are like, oh, is this well written? Is it poorly written? Like, some people said, like, this is really stupid, or this, oh no, it's just embracing its own stupidity, so it's technically smart. And I think really what Gurren Lagann does that works really well is it's conceptual. Like, that's the reason they blow through so many of these plot points so fast, is because here's this concept, okay, let's embrace it. They don't develop necessarily characters or themes in a deep, like, resonant way or a complicated way. They're just blowing through a concept. Let's plow this concept as hard visually and artistically as we can, and then let's go to the other one. And when you write like that, the pacing is very quick, you know, because you're not developing complex things that sort of need to sit and meditate emotionally. You're blowing through things that people can see and digest visually, and you know, like, it, you don't need to meditate really. So no wonder they got through the story so fast. The whole thing is artistically conceptual. So
yeah.
I will say that I think that's definitely one of the things that draws me to it the most. And that I definitely feel like I'm a very visual person, and even considering being involved in film and whatnot. I've always been more a visual person than an audio type person. And because the story is told largely visually, not so much through everyone's favorite exposition dumps or through a lot of, subtle character work or dialogue or anything like that. Of course, you can blow through it super quick and have the audience understand exactly what you mean in just a few sequences rather than having to spend episodes and episodes on all this stuff. And I will say, I feel like I will agree with the complaints about the dragginess in some parts of it, especially in the second part. It does feel like they padded a little bit of that out. But I also do feel like they did a little bit of that in the first half as well, especially episode four. Can we talk about episode four for a second?
Yeah, of course.
Because I don't think before watching it for the podcast, I had ever actually watched episode four all the way through, because I'd always been told, oh, that's the bad one.
It is, but not for the reasons you might think.
Not because the animation's quote-unquote bad.
Yes.
No,
it's
the
not.
Animation is the most interesting part about it, because it does have an interesting visual style. It just doesn't fit with the rest of the show at all.
So fun fact about that. That's the one that, like, Chan got really upset it was a producer at Gainax.
Yeah, there was a guy who lost his job over it.
The
guy who stepped down over it.
Yeah, the gentleman who stepped down over it was a very talented director named Osamu Kobayashi, who directed Paradise Kiss and Beck and a lot of...
a lot of 4C stuff,
Gainax and stuff like that. And, like, his work is really good, but it is completely, like, Kobayashi's work is entirely based around realism and sensory detail. Two things that have zero place whatsoever in Little Again, which is, like, cartoony heights and, like, you don't need to know how, like how the basement under the flophouse smells in Gurren Lagann. Not that there's a flophouse, but that's kind of what his work is.
Right,
like.
Yeah.
And, you know, like, it doesn't gel, and so it's just, like, it's weird, and I felt really bad for him, because it's not that the animation sucks, it's just
it doesn't really fit at all, it's just so out of place, and not suitable to this style.
Right.
And it also doesn't hurt that it seems like they didn't have much budget for that episode, because it was very obviously, like, look what's happening off screen here that we're not animating right
now. Well, episode fours are classically, because the first three episodes are usually what fans have arbitrarily decided on as the selling point for an anime series. Notoriously, episode fours in any given anime series are usually the ones to suffer visually. It's an old canard, and it's not always
so
true,
to have that, and also to have this guest animator with the out of place visual style, to not give him the resources he would need to actually make his style work at the same time hurts
it
even more.
I really do think it was just a style incompatibility straight up. Having seen his work, it just doesn't gel.
There are, admittedly, animation wise, there are some slow pans in this fucking show. That are brutal. Mm-hmm. Like, they're panning across the deck of the ship, and it is like a 3-minute conversation, or at least what feels like a 3-minute conversation. Holy shit! Like, the highs are high.
Right.
The time cut, whatever the fuck you want to call it. Don't fill up my Twitter yelling at me about budget stuff. The time cost, whatever resources cutting. Time saving is very noticeable.
I watch a lot of anime, as you know, and watching Gurren Lagann compared to your average show in terms of how they use resources and how it's spaced and even the budgetier shots or whatever, like, Gurren Lagann is absolutely a cut above. I have very little to complain about when
it looks fucking fantastic. The color design in it alone is just
amazing. Like, I love
amazing.
Nia's character design. It's funny, because I absolutely abhor, there is a recent trend in anime to make the pupils to try to make the eyes unique from every other anime character's eyes, so they just put random stuff in the pupils, and this can go very badly. This was a big thing for No Game, No Life, whose color design I absolutely abhorred in that show. I thought that show was hideous, but Nia looks great. Nia is like the perfect encapsulation of that super bloom, super over designed sort of look that a lot of things are going for now. And it's the good version of that. Like, it's kind of the this is what you were trying to do. Is Nia's really, really striking good character design. So
yeah, there's a reason this show was so heavily cosplayed. Not just the main characters, but basically everybody in the show has a great design that's worthy of being drawn or cosplayed or made sculptures out of, or I don't know. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, the cosplay was definitely a thing. It's still occasionally see Gurren Lagann cosplay every now and then. Like, the show has endured in as much as anything can.
Yeah,
it has endured. It is from a time before, though. Mm-hmm. Like, 10 years ago is the cusp of smartphones and social media. So you know, it does feel like it is just from just before the time when monoculture really died for good.
Yeah.
But so before we go into the second half, though, I did want to bring up one thing. In episodes 11 and 12, there was a moment where I thought the show might start to juxtapose the kind of masculinity that the show was selling, which was kind of this pure-hearted, still wildly sexist, but pure-hearted masculinity reaching for the stars or whatever. And I thought maybe they were going to be juxtaposing that against the Spiral King, who had obviously become sort of an authoritarian monster, which is the end result of that kind of hyper-aggressive, dominating masculinity that the show is selling.
It's to describe its specific flavor of masculinity, it's kind of like the stuff that you see in a lot of otaku media, like for Evangelion and for Fate Stay Night and stuff like that, that tries to comment on it. That's like the pubescent version. That's where you're, quote-unquote, a little woke after you've hit puberty and you're starting to look at these ideas about masculinity and whether or not you fit in it. Gurren Lagann is the prepubescent version. It is the childish optimism and full embrace of masculine ideals, even if they don't fit. Like, Simone is aware that he's not really the super alpha, awesome, like, pinnacle of this idea that Kamina is, but he still admires it without bitterness, and he still, like, embraces it without, like, without any real, like, resentment. And it's sort of like, it's coming from a place of privilege and ignorance and sort of egocentrism, but it's very innocent and open-hearted and childlike. It's kind of like the masculinity that you embrace if you're like a 7-year-old boy. It's like a 7-year-old boy playing with his tractors and his trucks and his planes and stuff like that.
Like, I don't think, like, the show is commentative on that stuff to an extent. The show overall, I don't think, is particularly commentative on much of anything, but I will say that, like, so say, like, you're the kind of person that doesn't really want to watch a 27-episode pay-on to bullshit masculinity. Like, it's a good show. It's worth watching. You will probably feel very fired up by the messages of the show. Just be warned ahead of time. There's a bunch of bullshit, cringy, unfunny, sexist crap in there.
Yeah.
Honestly, not as much of it as you might think. But there's plenty of it in there.
It's there's enough to make me a little uncomfortable. Even loving the show as much as I do, I have to admit that it does have those huge problems in terms of gender representation. Not just the over-masculinization of the male characters, but also the limited roles in which the female characters perform. Like, if they're strong, they're also busty. If they're not, then they're waifish and waiting to be rescued, that sort of thing.
Well, they're literally all maternal or love interests in some way. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, the women in the show are there to complete the metaphor that they have for masculinity, and you have to have a woman to contrast your masculinity with, otherwise you have like I get it.
Yeah,
I just didn't find it offensive.
Just to balance
I didn't find the show
Simon
offensive.
Simon gets from Kamina, basically.
I didn't like I said, I don't find the show offensive. There's just a bunch of cringy bullshit in there. Like, he's like, "What about your fat ass, you dumb broad," to Yoko, and you're like, "Okay, this is dumb shit. That's not funny or cool at all." Cringe, cringe, cringe. On to the next thing. It's just like there's shit like that you have to get past. If you can get past it, I think the show's totally worth watching.
Yeah, I give Gurren Lagann not a pass on that, but sort of examine it anthropologically because it is pure id. So all of the toxic masculinity, which it is, like the Gurren Lagann is based in natal, like infant, like in the womb, the ideas about toxic masculinity that are in, like given to you by society and you just don't really think about them, like that kind of stuff. It's very, very basic. But it's unexamined. It's kind of like JoJo's Bizarre Adventure. JoJo's Bizarre Adventure is full of the exact same stuff, where it's just pure id. It's pure, these are my feelings as a guy, and I'm not thinking about what I'm saying basically at all. These are just my feelings about what is virtuous and right in the world, etc. And I'm a very typical bros bro guy. And there's stuff that is sexist and like toxic in a way that it is like has clearly thought about these ideas and is trying to defend them to you and like trying to say, well, actually, like subjugation of minorities is okay or whatever. And Gurren Lagann and JoJo's are not like that at all. They're just unexamined. Like there's no, I would say Gurren Lagann almost doesn't have any thematic text. It almost doesn't have any like direct message that they actively thought about trying to examine or think about. It's just feelings, like, I think Simone, like, they even say, like, Simone just works on pure feelings, and so does the show. It's just feelings that are unexamined, and so you get this pure artistic id spewed everywhere, and then you get to look at it and figure out the subtext, which is very...
Yeah.
Let me, like, Gurren Lagann, hang on, I think the big thing is here, Gurren Lagann walks right up to the line of my burning passion and stops short of saying my burning passion as a straight man makes me superior to all of you.
Right.
It doesn't say that part.
Right.
And that's it's not because that's not its philosophy. It right. is trying to lift up humanity. It just does it through a masculine lens, which feels and reads as sexist. If you're okay with that, the show's right. pretty good.
I would say unexamined.
I disagree a little bit, at least.
Oh, go ahead, Aaron. I was just getting that point out. Go ahead.
Anything about gender other than this kind of masculinity is great. Because I do feel like, at least in the way that Kamina is presented and the way that he ends up as a character and where Simone ends up as a character as a result, I do feel like that baked into the narrative is this message, at least, that if you take just Kamina's approach to masculinity, you will eventually hit this destructive kind of end because you don't have any kind of way to balance it out. And it is revealed through a lot of scenes with Kamina, like especially when he speaks with Yoko, that he does have a lot of vulnerability inside of him that he refuses to address.
Sure.
So I really, really want to comment.
It really is kind of a lot of empty bravado with nothing else behind it.
Yeah,
and what
Simon
brings to it is he balances out this pure version of this masculinity that the show upholds while also bringing compassion to it. And I think something interesting I read actually was the very first scene of the show, the one that shows the future of the show before you realize what's going on, that never actually happens. Like, it takes place on the deck of the giant ship, and they're fighting in space. But a lot of details are different, like Simone's character design is slightly different, and Buta is a furry for some reason. but most key... They say that all the stars in the sky are our enemies, and they bust out this giant attack at everything at once. But by the end of the series, if we're getting into the second half now, by the end of the series, that message changes from the lights in the sky are our enemies to the lights in the sky are our friends. So even that's a very basic message, but I do feel like it's executed very well, and it's done with a lot of panache, and that's why it worked for me.
Yeah, definitely. And so I did want to absolutely comment on that. Like, so people would, I'm sure, immediately jump to contradict the whole, well, hang on, this isn't really an elevation of, like, pure strain masculinity because Simon is sort of a beta type character in using the, you know, using the toxic masculinity sort of term. But, like, Simon is a nerdy otaku type. Like, he is known for his intelligence and for his compassion and his sensitivity. And so that's the twist on this, is that the one thing Gurren Lagann adds to the whole, like, the supreme ideal of masculinity that is admittedly not imperialist or subjugation-based, which they go out of their way to show, to try and put that stuff to the side, which is good. I think that helps it age better.
Yeah.
But the twist they add on that is because they are making the show for otaku. They are making the show for nerds. They are not making the show for bros. So they do have to show that Kamina's way of life, like, yes, this is the ultimate appeal, like, the ultimate version of masculinity that you want to appeal to, but to make the otaku feel better, it is not sustainable and it will kill you, basically. It's like, you have to be, like, you have to be sensitive and emotionally understanding and nerdy and intellect-driven. But also manly. So add that to your dance card, and that's what the otaku, like, oh, that's me, I'm Simone. And it's like, guess what? You are secretly superior than the Kamina type. Like, if you emulate his strengths while holding on to the strengths that you have, you are the superior male. Which, that has been done in every Fate Stay Night.
If you combine these things... It's almost as though there's a direct visual metaphor for this in the show itself.
Mm-hmm. Oh, right, exactly, yeah, and the robot, yeah. So
notice that Simone's part is the head, and Kamina's is the body.
Yes, it is.
Well, I think as though maybe they were onto something out of this, too. Like,
And this is not a criticism, by the way. This is not like, oh, this is a problem. Like, again, it helps that this show has a very pure... you can criticize, you can say that it's a little bit irresponsible in its subtext, but for the most part, like, the show has a very pure, like, emotionally driven core. It's not really examining its own ideas, and it's fine for the most part. It's an elevation of the nerd guys are actually the most masculine that I can kind of get behind.
Like, yeah, especially because the other message of the show is basically humans are awesome and progress is great. Nerds can make anything happen if they try hard enough.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So before we sort of wrap up here and get into the Twitter questions, Aaron, do you want to run us quickly through the second half, the last about 10 episodes or so?
Okay, I'll admit I might miss a few details because I was able to review the first half for this podcast.
Sure. Well, so it's okay to just give us a brief plot. Most of it's technobabble, so you can just skip to the story part. Yeah, yeah.
Right, so basically after the fight at Teplin, humanity goes on for another 7 years or so and progresses to the point where they have this giant city, communist city. But before the fall of Teplin, there was a prophecy that the Spiral King gave about when the apes reach a million, then the moon will become Hell's Messenger and wipe out humanity, basically. And nobody really understands exactly what that means until one day, apparently, the millionth baby is born. And suddenly, this transforms Nia into a messenger of a race called the Anti-Spirals. And they... this race has taken it upon themselves to, as you find out, defeat what they call the Spiral Nemesis, which is this destructive force that results from the overexpansion of spiral beings in the universe. So they have halted their own evolution in the quest to stop this Spiral Nemesis from happening, basically. So they begin to attack, and of course the humans fight back. Nia gets spirited away. There's some drama between the humans who have grown up since the end of the first half of the series, including Roshu locks up Simon for a while because of reasons. Simon and Viral team up. And eventually they manage to get the Gurren Lagann to a state where they are able to blast out into space and find the Anti-Spirals and rescue Nia. And galaxy shenanigans ensue.
And, you know, they win.
Yeah, they win.
And it's awesome.
Well, and the Gurren Lagann upgrades, like, three or four more times into an increasingly...
silly robot.
Well, it, the engine core has a galaxy forming inside of it. That's how big and powerful it is. Which felt like already this story is stretching to its absolute thinnest... And it's obviously just an excuse to keep powering up the robot.
I mean, inherently,
honestly, that's what I enjoyed about it.
Yeah,
that's not a criticism.
Yeah,
laughing and smiling through all of it.
My issue is more that it took four episodes, and not four episodes for the climax, four episodes for the specific final battle within the climax.
Yeah.
And I didn't need that, but I do think the funniest, the most, like, notable image that Gurren Lagann has created is... the image of a giant robot sitting inside a giant robot sitting inside another giant robot. Like, that is inherently really funny. Just seeing a giant robot at the controls of another one, piloting it with another person inside that, like Matryoshka of super robots, is the funniest thing. Mm-hmm. But, you know, it's just trying to push things to their most dramatic, silly conclusion. And you can get fatigued with it, I certainly did, or not, but it's... you know, you can't accuse them of not going all out, certainly.
Right.
I found myself tuning out the technobabble and just staring at the animation and the visual compositions of individual scenes and a lot of the cuts. I mean, Sushiel was working fucking overtime on the show. Famously, he's very proud of all of his work on episode 15. Like, a lot of that is him. Mm-hmm. The cuts in the middle and near the end of that episode are some of the best ever.
I would say episode 15 is the most jaw-dropping visually of the show, personally.
Probably in... I feel like you could place it in the medium, as a shining example of.
Also, it's the only part of the show where I, because the Super Robots, especially from the 70s, is a big personal hole of mine. Episode 15 and the Spiral King stuff is the only episode where I recognized like the visual references. I was like, oh, this is the Evangelion one, because there's like a bunch of different visual references that they pull from different Super Robot shows and specifically.
Well, there's a lot of Ava visual references.
Yeah, I mean there are, but I meant specifically the robots that they're piloting. Lord Genome's robot is an Ava.
Right.
So it's like, oh, okay, I know that one. You know.
Yeah,
I know, and I do feel terrible that I don't know more about this kind of thing, because it seems like there's a wealth of material to be discovered in this genre. Because I like this show so much, I should take to more shows that are like it, but I've never really been able to get into like the Getter Robos and the Mazingers and the anything else like that, really.
Well,
I don't know if it's just because I'm shallow and those shows are old, but
you went on the roller coaster version. Gurren Lagann is the big, exciting, flashy, expensive, big-budget roller coaster version of a 1970s giant robot show. The old shows are badly animated and cruddy-looking, and I know a lot of people love them. And that's part of their charm, is that they're badly animated and cruddy. But they're also pretty slow. Storytelling's come a long way since then. It's an acquired taste or something you needed to have grown up with. I don't feel any like I'm not really into that stuff either. Like, I'm curious about it. I like reading about it. I like knowing about it. I like looking at the art. I would like to read a book about the production on those shows. The act of sitting through 78 episodes of Die Rugger 5 or whatever, I don't really want to do it. I'm
yeah, and more power to people who do. But
absolutely. And like those guys, you want so like, in other words, I'm selfish and lazy. And I want to have a conversation with those guys about that show rather than sitting there and inhaling it all myself. And there's also a ton of it.
I was to say, everything had 50, 60 episodes back then, too. So.
Yeah, the size intimidation is definitely a factor.
So I feel like Gurren Lagann, you can watch it, and if you're picking up the visual references, first of all, look up Getter Robo. Look it up. Absolutely look it up. And look up Kenny Ishikawa, and look up his work. That is where a huge chunk of the visual references in Gurren Lagann come from. I'm familiar enough with it to know that and recognize that, including some shots and stuff like that. So I feel like it's a good gateway, but you may not. It might be a gateway to learning rather than a gateway to a new wealth of entertainment. Like, oh man, I'm going to watch hundreds of episodes of 70s super robot anime. Like, maybe not. Like, maybe you're not going to do that.
I will say it opened the gateway to a lot of that music, at least. Now I have a giant collection of old super robot opening theme songs on my iTunes that I like to listen to sometimes.
Gal Gaigar is my personal favorite.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Because that's the music, at least, you can listen to in short bursts and it gets you fired up for a little while.
Yeah. You know, it's also important to point out this is a Gainax show. Through and through.
Yeah.
Through and through. It is largely a collection of brilliant artistry, anime references, self-referential anime references. So referencing Gainax's shows. The plot is controlled chaos for the most part. Feels like it was written in an afternoon and then rewritten the afternoon after that. The production stories behind this, that they were prepared for another Evangelion-like ending where they had to animate it using crayons and the copier,
right.
Because they were so far, the production was such such chaos.
Like that, yeah. Mm-hmm.
You can't tell, mm-hmm. But not like Ava.
I feel like that's having seen plenty of Gainax shows that really fell apart and said, okay, time to ape Evangelion again, we're out of ideas. This is not that. So Takamura, I don't remember his name, Kazuki something, who wrote Gurren Lagann, like, I would say that he is much more cohesive. Like I said, he's working in high concepts, but the fact that he basically lets the artistic design of the show inform his writing and just keeps it simple and doesn't add too many ideas really makes it feel a lot more cohesive and well written. Not smart, mind you, not deep, but like overshooting itself, not wasting your time, not trying to be something it's not. It's just keeping the writing on the level of the artistic influences and kind of keeping it there. He did it with Kill la Kill with Fibers, and with this, it was Spirals. It's like, okay, Spirals, evolution, progression, manly spirit, procreation, those are your themes. And then he just puts that into all of the words, and it matches the imagery, and fine, it makes sense. And then the characters are very basic and works. My point is, Gurren Lagann is way more cohesive and simple and not fucked up writing-wise compared to a lot of Gainax shows, as I would say.
We got a lot of questions asking us to compare this to what is effectively the second draft of it, which is Kill la Kill. If you've seen Kill la Kill and you haven't seen this, it is literally impossible to not think about it while you're watching it, because they're basically the same right. show in so many words. Now, that's reductive and shitty. I feel like I can say that on this podcast because the people listening will understand what I mean by that. It is in no way intended to dismiss or diminish the artistic achievement that either of them are. However, Kill la Kill is clearly a redraft of this for the most part.
And what's interesting is it was almost a very literal redraft in that when they was kind of going through a little pre-production hell, because it was... the biggest thing that helped them break out of it, that said, like, okay, we really do have an outline here, we can go forward, was for the longest time, it was another cast of all dudes, and it was about masculinity again. Right. Is it Go Nagai? It's playing on, like, Naked Kamen and Cutie Honey and stuff
right,
like that.
Right, yeah, that's Go Nagai.
But instead of giant robot shows, but it was going to be dudes, and they were like, wait, let's just make it all women. And that changed the story just enough to make it, to give them the drive to plow into it. And personally, I think it makes it a better show, but that's just me. I think Kill la Kill is better than
I firmly come down on the side that they are both... If you're an anime fan now, I feel like you need to see both of them. Mm-hmm. I think they're both really important shows.
Oh, yeah. I wouldn't mm-hmm. say, like...
I would argue that if you're going to watch the one that's more influential, Gurren Lagann.
Yeah. I don't know. I feel like in many ways, Kill la Kill is, like, a better-made show, a better-written show. A lot of the characters have a little bit more to them. Even though it's a show about women in super bikinis, basically, it has better gender representation and gender politics going on. But for some reason, I still come down more on the Gurren Lagann side in terms of liking it better. Maybe because it is a little simpler. I felt like Kill la Kill kind of went all over the place sometimes, and it was a little hard to center myself in it at times. But I overall still really love both shows, and I would definitely also recommend that both are watched if you are going to watch some shows like this.
Yeah, I gotta say, like, I come firmly to you should watch them both.
Mm-hmm.
Firmly.
Yeah.
Watch them both.
Yeah.
You'll pick one, whichever one you like more, you will pick one that mm-hmm. appeals to you. They're both great. I think you should watch them both.
Yeah, well, here's the thing. Like, it is really, really interesting that the same director, the same art team, the same writers remade the show at Kill la Kill, and yet they do not feel like one can substitute the other. They do feel like completely different experiences, even though they are fundamentally the same thing. I don't know how this happened, but it did. Like, I don't think that one experience can supplant the other. Me personally, I prefer Kill la Kill because I think that the character writing is really strong. I think fundamentally what it's doing... It's interesting that so because Gurren Lagann was about masculinity, like, pretty explicitly, it's about masculinity and guy identities and stuff like that. It's tied to human evolution, but it's, you know, it's from that perspective. They couldn't do that when they decided to gender flip Kill la Kill in production. They couldn't write about femininity. They couldn't write about that or from a female perspective, and they knew that they couldn't do that, so they didn't try. And instead, they wrote about this universal human experience stuff, dropped the macho part, kept the female characters' motivations and stuff, like, sort of macho. They didn't do the thing where they slotted them all into maternal roles like in Gurren Lagann. And it kind of created this beautiful alchemy of something I've never really seen before characterization-wise, where the female characters are responsible for, like, the villainy and the heroism and the comic relief and everything in this. And but it's not about femininity. It's not like a Sailor Moon type thing where it's like, and it's super girly. It just feels like it's about the human condition, and I just thought that was really neat. Like, it was sort of an accidentally, nominal thing. So, yeah, to me, like, Kill la Kill is better because I think the writing is stronger, and that's kind of it. But yeah, like, they both feel like such unique experiences, even though they're kind of about the same thing.
Yeah, like, just from my perspective, like, if you're an anime fan or you're interested in anime as visual medium, you have to see both of them. And I would argue that, like, if I had to pick one where I would want to see, like I would really love to see, like, a 3D, like an art installation that where you could walk through scenes from one of these shows. The space stuff in Gurren Lagann, if you could recreate that in a 3D space and I could walk through it, I feel like that... like in my brain, that's so cool. And there's nothing quite like that in Kill la Kill. It, towards the end, yeah, in the climax, but some of the space imagery in the towards the end of Gurren Lagann is so unique and so spectacular visually that that's maybe it's just because I just saw it, but well, no, holy
shit,
it's cool.
I think thematically and fundamentally they're very different. And what I like about Kill la Kill is that it is intentionally messier, and it is about intentionally much messier solutions. Like Gurren Lagann, again, so that Gurren Lagann uses drills, uses spirals, and it's about human evolution and the perfection of man and mankind and everything. And Kill la Kill's metaphor is fibers, specifically like messy, weak, flimsy fibers that bond together. Like, so Kill la Kill is all about like forming bonds with other people and becoming stronger, even though you're a kind of, you're a displaced, fucked up human being, becoming stronger by bonding with other displaced, fucked up human beings. And to me, that's more interesting. And so the visual style of it is messier, and it's less, it's more uncouth, and it's more bizarre. Even down to the way that the line work is done in it, where Gurren Lagann has very clean line work. A lot of Kill la Kill rides on things looking all messy and tangled and scratchy. So, you know, like, that's, it's just a personal, it, it just kind of depends on what you find more appealing.
Yeah.
No, I think that's a great way to sum it up. And I think that's a, it's a really good way to distinguish what you'll take away from both shows and which side you'll come down on. Like I said, I really respect Kill la Kill for being the way it is and for portraying itself the way that it does. I just happen to prefer the sort of more tight, clean experience of Gurren Lagann, and that's the personal thing. So that's really all I can say about it.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I'm, to me, that's kind of a relief. Because if I had to sit here and be like, Kill la Kill's better, you don't need to watch this, I would feel...
Yeah, that would suck.
That would kind of suck. Mm-hmm. But instead, it's like these are both vital experiences.
Yeah, it's nice that they made like two completely different artistic statements that are basically the same thing but different. Like, it... You know, it's really neat and doesn't...
It's like a double album. You need to listen to both.
Yeah.
Where both albums are really good for different reasons, but they're both part of the same double set. Like...
Right.
Yeah.
They're about the same... They're about the same thing. Although I do think that the biggest thing... again, the writing is better. In Kill la Kill, they got rid of a lot of the technobabble problems.
Oh, God. That started driving me fucking crazy.
The technobabble of
I might have
Gurren
a higher
Lagann
tolerance
is not
for
necessary.
That, but yeah, I agree.
Yeah, the technobabble of Gurren Lagann isn't tied into the thematic or character anything. It just stops the story to go. And thousands of years ago, they seeded something on the moon to blah, blah, blah. In Kill la Kill, all of the technobabble is in service of the character and the theming, where it's like...
Not all of it.
Most of it. The life fiber thing is literally like humans evolved because they wore clothes. Like literally. So they're able to kind of tie it into everything instead of like trying to come up with an anti-spiral. Oh, they were humans, but now they're in a vegetative state because they didn't want to evolve and they seeded the moon. You know, like I don't, Kill la Kill's world building is built into its characters a little more cleanly, where they don't just literally stop the plot and explain something to you that's not rooted in character. But that's just me. So.
All right. Well, I think we should get to the Twitter questions. All right? Everybody ready for those?
Oh, yeah.
Any? Okay. All right. Mouse in House asks, do you think Gurren Lagann suffered an 11th hour script change, like, you know, in regard to the more politicized second half? I mean, we've discussed that. Basically, like, it feels like they ran through all the story they had in the first 15, 16, mm-hmm. then had to fill another 10 up.
I think they were,
There's a recap episode.
Well, you mentioned that thing at the beginning where it's like all the lights in the sky are our enemies, and then it becomes all the lights in the sky are our friends. Like, I do think that they were kind of constantly going, wait, no, that's not quite what we want to say constantly through it. Because, again, it's pure id. Like, they don't really examine what they're saying. They're just like, here's what I feel in this moment. And the biggest place that jumps out to me is Rossiu, who goes from being like, he turns into a villain. They do not characterize it like in a way that makes sense at all. They just sort of need to shoehorn him into this villain position. And then in order to fix that so that it doesn't feel like they're making an anti-intellectual argument, because it was beginning to look like they were making an anti-intellectualism argument, they have him go through the same character arc that Simone went through of doubting himself and trying to supplant somebody that he was envious of with Simone that went through Kamina. And they do a good job of it. I like Rossiu's redemption a lot, because I think without it, it could have been... Like, Rossiu turning into a villain would have kind of made the show more unpleasant. And so, yeah, I think my point is, like, I think they do kind of backpedal and switch back a couple times in the writing, but it still feels cohesive, and usually in a Gainax show it doesn't. Usually it feels like they fucked it up. So it just happened to work really well this time.
Yeah. And I think it helps that they seeded that pretty well earlier on in the series with how he enters the story and the episode he's introduced in, with that whole episode being basically a little microcosm of where the entire series is going, right. And also just sort of him taking away influences from his elder, maybe subconsciously as he grows up.
Yeah, I think they absolutely always knew that they were going to make Rossiu the well-intentioned villain since he was introduced. Like, that was definitely going to happen. I think just once they got there, they went, oh, we didn't really... This isn't, you know, we thought this at the beginning, but he's changed since then, and now it doesn't make sense. So they had to backpedal, and they did it in a way that was endearing.
The next question is from TD Crimson King, and he asks, favorite mech design from the show? And I'm calling King Catan right here.
That star, yeah, it's pretty great.
Because that's easily... I like the Galaxy Gurren-Lagann, too. That thing is rad as hell. And most of the... I mean, the Arc Lagann's kind of whatever... There's really good mech design in this show.
all of them are really good. I think you hit the nail on the head with the most striking one.
That thing. And the Evolutions were all good, too. Like, yeah, that's a good model. I might get one of those.
Personally, I feel like I like a lot of just the rank-and-file gunmen that they come up against, because that's what's so striking when you first start to watch the series, is you've never really seen this style of mecha before with these giant heads and distorted faces in mech anime before, basically.
Yeah.
I really like the big dog-faced gunman that first attacks them in episode one, really. Mm-hmm. I don't know if that's my favorite, but it sticks out to me.
I like the ugly little bunnies in the hot spring episode. They're like little Energizer bunnies, and they have like little Watership Down teeth.
Those were cute. let's see. GV Mans, who asks, did the heavy amount of references suck the emotional impact out of some scenes? I'm referring to that one death. So I know that Kamina's death was largely rendered as a gigantic homage to Super Robot. Like, I know that's a reference to something, and I'm sure there are people listening to this who are ripping their hair out and wish that I had invited them on the show. This is legitimate. I should have gotten a Super Robot guest to come on with Aaron to have the dual commentary. But please go into the forums and tell us what reference we missed during that death scene. There's a shot of him in all white that looks like Ashton Ojo, which I'm pretty sure...
That's what I was thinking.
Is that what it is? Is it no more complicated than Ashton Ojo? Because then I knew it. I knew what it was.
I mean, I don't think... But that's the thing. There isn't any part of Gurren Lagann that relies on reference for you to understand. There isn't...
No, but you still want to catch the reference.
Oh, yeah, but...
It's still fun.
They were asking if it undercut, and...
I don't think so. It was kind of fun. I was like, oh, is that Ashton Ojo? It still works.
Yeah.
It's still emotionally
effective.
I feel
like the references were a little more intrusive in Kill la Kill, honestly. Like, I didn't feel like any references in Gurren Lagann necessarily hampered the experience, especially because I don't know what those references are.
Yeah. Well... All right. Let's move on here. BioD42 asks... How much of Gurren Lagann's themes is dependent on privilege? And how well do they work despite that? I mean, we've talked about
1,000% of them, but it works pretty well.
It works well.
Mostly because the show
it's like you'll have cringy moments, but overall it still works.
Yeah.
If the show was super serious, it wouldn't really. But it, yeah.
How many times did you scream, "The wrong one died" at the screen? Never. Because it was pretty clear to me who was going to die. Yeah. I've seen Nadesco.
Also, Kitan, like, when it became clear that they had nothing for him to do in the show except follow Kamina, I was just waiting.
Oh, yeah. Like, that was like, not shocking at all to me.
Come on, God, you know, just get rid of him.
I knew more supporting cast members would die. Had to.
Yeah.
Better cosplay character, Yoko from Gurren Lagann or Ryuko from Kill la Kill. The Kill la Kill costume...
It takes effort.
No, they both take effort.
Well, yes. You're right.
But that Kill la Kill costume, I feel, is riskier.
Yeah.
It's harder to pull off.
Yes.
Yeah, there's a lot more going into it. Yoko...
it's just a bikini and some
it's
shorts.
It's a bikini and some Daisy Dukes. You gotta
Unless you're doing that star thing that she's wearing at the end.
Yeah, that would be lovely.
Yeah. I don't think I've ever seen anyone try to pull that off, though. You would have to have titanic boobs to pull that shit off, though.
I think you just have D cups and latex and it would work.
Well, let's talk about this creepily.
Creepily? You're just talking about...
It's my fault. I brought it up.
All
right. Watch too much Gurren Lagann and you think about tits a lot. Mine Half Full asks, Who put Kamina on a higher pedestal, the characters in the show or the fans of the show online? So you had a fun fun anecdote about this.
Okay, so way back when, and in anticipation of maybe doing a video on it that never really came to fruition, I asked about people's anime crushes, and this was back when I could hold a survey like this and get like hundreds upon almost like 1,000 responses. I can't say thousands multiple, but it may have been over 1,000. You know, it was hundreds of responses to who people thought was the most attractive anime character. And just out of curiosity, I also I said, well, you know, like, report your own demographics, and you know, this is mostly for straight women. But if you are a straight man, a gay man, or a straight man, you can say what your anime man crush would be. But you know, just be honest about your gender and everything. And so the results for the female side of it were fairly normal. Like the winners, I guess you could say the overwhelming winners were Spike from Cowboy Bebop and Sebastian from Black Butler. Make of that what you will. But notably, all of the straight men who voted, and it was a lot of them because that was, you know, there's a lot of, you know, that's a large demographic who were participating. Overwhelmingly voted for, and this was write-in vote. There were no options. There was no bias. You put your own vote in for Kamina, and no women. Like, women did not ever vote for Kamina. Like, a couple maybe, but it was so negligible in number. But overwhelmingly, the straight male participation, if they're like, well, I'm straight, but if I had to fuck a guy, it would be Kamina. And I think that's extremely fascinating because Kamina is like, no women are interested in him because he's a sexist pig. And he's stupid.
No, Yoko falls in love with him.
Well, I meant real women.
Basically every other woman other than, like, the mechanic lady.
Yeah, not the fictional characters. I meant the women who voted on this.
Oh.
No women voted for Kamina. They weren't really interested. But men just absolutely, like, adored Kamina. Like, it was overwhelming. The only, like, the distant second was Alucard from Helsing, which I don't even want to think about that one. But so overwhelming.
Well, girls can be pretty fucked up about that stuff. Anyway, moving on.
No, guys.
Oh, wait. The other one was
Alucard.
They wanted to fuck Kamina and Alucard.
Alucard was a distant second. It was.
Oh, this is a daddy fantasy.
Well, here's the thing that's really, really interesting to me because it's like, well, women aren't interested in what Kamina has to offer watching that show because, yeah, he's irresponsible and dumb and sexist and all this other stuff. But guys who aren't really attracted to men, they're like, well, I guess this guy because they're attracted to this idea. Deal, I guess, of who they want to be. If Gurren Lagann really did tap a nerve with that audience and really did speak to them on that level, then it's like, well, this is the success. They really created this character that is like so desirable to want to be that he's like almost sexually attractive.
Yeah.
Which I think is hilarious. I can't get over how many guys in anonymous fashion said, "Oh yeah, Kamina. Like that is who I would want to stick his dick in my butt." You know, is Kamina from Gurren Lagann. So there you go. Like, say what you will about the psychology of guys, Kamina. I don't know. Interesting.
I'm trying to figure out if I would fuck Kamina.
I wouldn't. No, thank you.
I don't think so.
No.
He's good looking, but I don't think so.
Yeah. Sorry, I just...
No comment.
Yeah. Well, anyway. Let's see. Ford DM asks, for Jacob, have your thoughts or opinions changed since your old video review?
I have a more nuanced take on it. I mean, my opinion emotionally has not changed. My review, for those of you who watched it forever ago, was mostly like, oh, this is really dumb. This is an artistic statement that is not particularly profound on any level other than an artistic statement. And... I would agree with that, but I would also say, like, subtextually, it's interesting for all the reasons we said in this podcast. I never talked about the subtext of masculinity in that review because that would have been like an essay. But yeah, like it's dumb. It's mostly an artistic expression, like visual art, rather than a scripted narrative that's particularly complex. So,
All right, okay. Zero Intelligence asks, did the first episode live up to the expectations of Simone's character? God damn.
Simone.
Alvin, Simone.
That's okay.
Theodore.
I think I said Simon a few times earlier.
Live up to the expectations of Simone's character as an older teenage adult by the end of the show. So, you know, I think it's like, so that early flash, I think that was just meant to be like, here's where the show's going.
Right.
And then they didn't wind up going there specifically.
I think, if anything, that they that their feelings on that changed as they wrote it to be like, well, we don't want this to be a bold, like, the Conqueror type thing. As the show went, they more and more pared back on ideas of imperialism or subjugation that might be implicit in the material. Like, every time they thought, like, every time that popped up somewhere, they were like, oh, well, we don't really mean that. That's a little much. So Simone is softer, and he's fighting to rescue his lady love rather than to defeat his enemies.
I was saying before, I think I forgot to actually finish my thought on that point before when talking about that first scene versus how it ends up. I think now, in terms of people reading that scene as what it is, as opposed to like what it could have been, I think people now read that first scene in the first episode as what could have been the future. It's basically an alternate future of the Conqueror that Simone could have become if he had actually gone down the Kamina path rather than taking the more the more compassionate path that he ends up taking.
Right.
Right. Let's see. A Mind Half Full asks, wait, no, different person. QA the Third asks, how do you feel about it when people compare Gurren Lagann to Evangelion? Personally, I feel it's off base to compare them. Well, one draws significantly from, like, so Gurren Lagann draws significantly from Evangelion, but only in a few very recognizable and very sort of surfacey ways. Other than that, like, you would discuss them both in a paper you were writing about Gainax, and in pretty much no other scenario would you really need to compare them to. Compare them to each other. I don't see the point. What's the point? Completely different goals, artistically and creative. Like, yeah, come on.
Like, yeah, really, you can only say Gainax made both, and both made a significant impact on the anime scene when they came out.
Mm-hmm. And Gurren Lagann pulls a lot from having because everything does.
I like the one reference I don't think we'd really mentioned yet is at the very end they have an alternate timeline fantasy. And I was like, well, sit through this side road for a bit here.
Maraxmers asks, which stylistic Gainax mech show holds up better, Gurren Lagann or Die Buster? I need to see Die Buster again. I haven't seen it since it came out. And that was a long ass time.
I suspect it would
ago.
Be Gurren Lagann just because for there's sure. a lot more room to characterize than Die Buster gets. And I remember Die Buster having some kind of like questionable tangents within itself. But I really remember liking how it ended at the very least.
Yeah. I need to see it again. I don't remember having a strong opinion of it. Other than thinking like, oh, they just made Gunbuster look like Fooly Cooly.
Yeah, I really can't remember anything about it other than that last episode and the last image that they see that ties into the original Gunbuster.
You know, I gotta be honest, I only remember about three scenes from the original Gunbuster. I never went crazy for Gunbuster like a lot of people did you?
Not really. Like, I watched it once and I really enjoyed it just because we were just a whole bunch of friends watching it together.
It's good.
But mostly I remember, like, there's some training scenes and then there are robots and then stuff happens.
It's good, but yeah. I don't know, man. It's all right.
I have never seen it, so don't worry.
Maybe we'll do a podcast on Gunbuster. Whoa, man. Whew.
I do feel like I should revisit it, though, because in describing it that way, I feel like I didn't give it justice for how beloved it is by a certain subset of fans.
Oh, totally.
And I do feel like that there's probably something there that I'm not remembering properly.
Watching this maybe want to watch
that. I'm older.
Yeah, watching this maybe want to watch that. So I'll, yeah. All right, No New Type asks, has it aged well or has it been lapped by shows with similar creative impulses that have a more personal, emotional focus and themes? It's aged very well, I think. It's aging really well.
Thing.
Yeah, it's its own thing. It's been incredibly influential. Unbelievably influential.
And you know, it's a good thing it came out in 2007, because if you think about the like Tumblr scrutiny that Kill la Kill fell under when it came out.
Oh.
Kill la Kill was infinitely more like progressive and female friendly than Gurren Lagann. Can you imagine the Tumblr scrutiny?
No, and I don't want to.
No.
Yeah, you were saying, like it came out just on the cusp of the social media boom. It's basically, I didn't hear much in the way of like people talking about it episode to episode like I heard for Kill la Kill.
Yeah.
And I think that's definitely
all of that. So it's
a factor in why it wasn't scrutinized quite as much.
The war, it would have been so ugly. I'm so glad it came out before that.
Anime Wondering asks, why do you think so few anime have managed to successfully emulate the ever-increasing scale of the show's second half? Well, the second half, all that dumb leveling up works because they executed it well. And it's unpretentious. It's pretty obvious what it's trying to do and what it's doing. And it's just about getting to those moments where the ship is the ship, the robot is evolving again. Mm-hmm. And I didn't have a problem with that. That was fine. And that's also almost impossible to do, like, over and over again. You can't, like, just keep repeating it. The scale only gets so big, and they went about as big as you can get reasonably without going into the pure abstract to the point where it just doesn't make any sense anymore.
Yeah. And apparently they did that in the movie. Like, I have actually never seen the movies, but apparently there's, like, one more iteration that's the size of, like, 10 universes.
Yeah, they hyped that a lot. I didn't watch the movies for this either because they're recap movies, but they're we have them on the shelf. I should take a look at what that final... If that's in there, I should take a look.
Yeah, there's a little comparative graphic on the Gurren Lagann Wikipedia that shows, like, this is the universe, and this is the drill of the Super Tengen Toppa Gurren Lagann, and it's like 10 times the size.
Yeah. All right. We got to plow through these next few. Boneheimer asks, great username, did you find Naya's death necessary for the show's themes, or was it just added for a bittersweet ending? That was an anime thing.
Mm-hmm.
Anime, how do you mean?
We're Japanese people making a thing, so they die at the end.
It has to be sad, yeah.
Yeah.
But, and also, like, Simone had to go wander the world endlessly for true freedom. He can't be part of the system, man.
Mainly, so also mainly, you have to have big, hot, manly tears.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. At best, you could read it as a parallel to Kamina's death. Those are his two major influences, thematically speaking, and whatnot, so it kind of makes sense that he doesn't have either at the end.
He can't wander the world with his true, free, supermanly soul, free of the system, with a wife, so right. Off she goes.
Hmm. Blues Drive Monster asks, Gurren Lagann is very open about its inspirations, especially Getter Robo. Do you feel like this limits its quality? No. I don't think it's so beholden. Like, if you're super familiar with that stuff, you might be thinking, man, this is... There's so many references. It feels like a collection of references. If you don't know 70s robot anime, like the back of your hand, you are not going to notice any of that stuff.
Yes, yeah, not a bit.
So it's kind of a self-selecting audience on that one. Miles, your friend of mine from Crunchyroll, asks, in its heyday, I imagine that Gurren Lagann would be the definitive anime remembered from the decade. Do you think it has? Why or why not? Well, I think that's tough to call, because if you asked me, of the decade, which decade? It feels weird to count 2000 to 2010 as a decade. That just doesn't seem right. It's more like 2000. It's more like 95 to 2005, 2005 to now.
Yeah,
and we just entered a new decade almost. Like it's
right. And 2005 to not now, but before the advent of simulcasting everything in, like, 2012 or something.
Is its own age,
and it is a little bit of a lost age, so I would say it's one of the most remembered things from that age, certainly.
Yes. Mm-hmm. I would say of the last 15 years, this would be on a top 5 shows that you need to watch.
Of the last 15 years?
Most remembered.
Yeah, like, the only other thing that's coming to mind as something that sort of looms from that era in my head might be The Melancholy of Haruhi Suzumiya.
See, the thing is, that is definitive, I feel.
Yeah.
That is the definitive show that has absolutely held on, like, well, not held on to its fandom, but in its place as remembered. This is something people will reference. If you bring up anime in the 2000s, it is Haruhi Suzumiya and Gurren Lagann.
Right. In the 2000s, like, the latter half of the 2000s, the Moe boom, the bubble popping, the tumbleweeds between home release and simulcasting.
Yeah, the digital fan sub craze and the difference between that and the home release.
It is a picture, it's a black and white picture of Haruhi's face with the word obey under it. That is that period of time in fandom. Yes.
Okay, last question from Link3693. What do you think of Liron? Do you think he manages to nicely go beyond the anime gay stereotype he's part of?
No.
He's
competent.
That's he's just presented as someone who helps out and occasionally makes horrible stereotypical comments about fucking straight dudes that have no interest in him. Which is annoying and
really
dumb and
me.
Bullshit.
Like, just rewatching it for the podcast, I forgot how bad it was in the early episodes.
It is terrible in the early episodes.
And
I
one
would...
thing I did forget, though, was I actually even, like, took a picture of it with my phone when it happened, because I was like, wait a minute, I don't remember that. is one of the first lines he says is, "I am neither a man nor a woman."
Yeah, so I was gonna like break out a checklist. It's like, okay, so of hoary old gay panic stereotypes that are not exclusive to Japan, it was a thing in America as well. It's just a little further back. Like the giant checklist, the one Liron breaks away from that, like, makes him not as stereotypical as he could be, is he's competent. That's it. Like, he's good at a thing that is not related to his sexuality and is helpful and not like a weasel or something.
He's shown us consistently competent and loyal.
Yeah, everything else.
Yeah, competent, loyal, and empathetic.
Right. Everything else, which is confusing gender with sexuality, confusing homosexuality with pedophilia, all of those other things, is only considered good because he is sterile, etc. All of those things, 1,000% the worst version of the stereotype. So yeah, Liron is the struggo gay panic stereotype, except he's competent, which is the one thing he has that's different from the worst possible case scenario. But yeah, apart from that, there's really not much you can say for it other than, yep, it's a stereotype.
Yeah. The only thing I would say is that while we are also watching the show and placing it into context with all the sexism, 2007 was 1 year before the passing of Proposition 8 in California. That's in the United States.
Yeah.
So I just want to point out that, like, even 10 years ago, things were not going so great.
No, I want to clarify. I don't think, like, legally, you could split hairs about, like, the U.S. is more progressive.
I mean, look, I'm not trying to draw any. I'm just saying, like, the world was in a different place.
It was, yeah.
Back
yeah.
then.
But it's like, I don't think that the difference is particularly large, frankly, when it comes to media representation from what I have seen. But it's significant, but it's not as large as you'd like to think. So, yeah.
Yeah. Well, I think that about wraps us up. Aaron, thank you so much for coming on and getting through this with us. I feel like we answered all the tough questions and really dug in, so thank you so much.
Oh, thank you so much for having me. It's always a pleasure.
Okay, that's our show. Big thanks to Aaron for stopping by. The theme song is Bucharest. It's by the band The New Division. You can check them out at newdivisionmusic.com. Don't forget, subscribe to us on iTunes, leave us a rating or a review. We'd really appreciate it. And I'll see you all next week.